aspect of this story, Saeed, is other leaders condemning the scenes. And one thing I want to pick up on, actually, and a lot of people have mentioned this, Boris Johnson taking to his platform to condemn the scenes. Basically, a lot of people find the notion of Britain condemning, you know, the undermining of democracy as highly hypocritical, because Britain has been involved with her allies, people would say, doing this around the world for many, many years. And so a lot of people are highly critical of Boris Johnson, you know, and they see him as very similar to Donald Trump. Tom actually tweeted on this aspect of the story, and Tom says, "The audacity of Boris Johnson to condemn the events in the US, the very Prime Minister who utilised the same tactics to divide and conquer the UK, all in pursuit of personal gain. Sickening, sickening hypocrisy."
Hypocrisy. And Richard, we're fresh out of time. We're going to have to leave it right there. Richard Sedan with that story. Richard, thank you as always. Time to look at some other stories now. China has refused calls from the European Union and the United Nations to release Hong Kong activists arrested on January 6th on charges of conspiring with external forces when it comes to internal affairs. More than 50 activists linked to violent unrest during the 2019 political protests were detained for questioning under the country's national security law. Authorities believe the activists helped run an unofficial primary to pick opposition candidates ahead of Hong Kong elections. Suspected foreign interference is thought to have played a significant role in 2019's upheaval, which inspired the country's national security law. The European Commission says it secured 300 million extra doses of the new Pfizer-BioNTech coronavirus vaccine after growing criticism that it had not done enough to secure jabs for the entire bloc. The EU now has the capacity to vaccinate 380 million people. That's more than 80% of the bloc's population. In total, 600 million vaccines will be available, the majority of them from April. In Germany, lawmakers have criticized the decision to give the Commission the handling of the vaccines for all member states. The World Health Organization has called on European countries to do more to curb a new variant of coronavirus first detected in the UK. The organization's regional director for Europe, Dr. Hans Klug, said that 22 countries in the region have detected the mutation in their COVID patients and that this is alarming. The new variant is said to be 70% more transmissible than its predecessors, making it more difficult to keep in check. Earlier this week, the UK reported its highest daily deaths and infections from the virus since the peak of the pandemic in April last year. Ukrainians have held Orthodox Christmas celebrations despite the pandemic and widely without masks and social distancing. The nation has reported more than a million cases and over 20,000 deaths. Yet the government placed no restrictions on Christmas festivities this year. People visited restaurants and Christmas markets without masks, although the government had announced it would be placing the country under a nationwide lockdown from January 8th. Reports have claimed that Britain is the least racist country in Europe, despite evidence from the government's own sources that institutional racism and racist attacks remain prominent in British life. Press TV's Richard Sedan asks if Britain really is the least racist country in Europe.
While many people do indeed argue that Britain is less of a racist country than others, the reality, according to experts on the ground like Lee Jasper, is a far cry from the image some would like Britain to have.
In the United Kingdom, we have more inter-ethnic, inter-religious cohabitations and marriages than any other place in the world. But when you look at the scale of institutionalized racism and systemic disadvantage, then we compare with America or some other countries around the world where racism and its institutional character is much more profound.
We have a big feeling of entitlement in Britain as it is as a culture. So to say that Britain is the least racist country in the world, I believe that's another cover-up story that they always tend to try to put on this country and even around Europe, around racism, to try and cover up the reality that you still are very racist in your views towards people around people of other cultures.
While many are quick to point the finger at street racism, many more are making the connection between institutional and structural racism and power as the real issue.
In fact, what we've seen on average is two immigration bills being introduced every single year since 2020. And so we're just ratcheting up, making it more difficult, making it more hostile, immigration legislation, to the extent now where, you know, we're deporting black British citizens to countries that they've never ever been to and have no association with.
To talk about immigrants in such a way, to talk about people, human beings that need help and come here, a country you keep promoting to the world, because I've been around the world, I've lived in other countries and I've heard their perception of Britain. They look at Britain as a haven, as like almost like a safe place from the problems that exist in the world that are killing people. So when they come here, they see the farce.
For many communities, and especially young black people, the police remain one of the main reasons as to why Britain is not the anti-racist utopia that many try to frame Britain's image around.
They've come to understand very quickly that they're third-class citizens living in a supposed first-class democracy, and that, as we've seen just this week with the announcement that 9 out of 10 young people in youth offenders establishments in the United Kingdom are BME offenders. 61% of them are black, the rest are made up of Muslim and other ethnic minorities. I mean, that is a catastrophic figure.
They haven't helped. They've made the problem worse. When you put more police on the streets searching more black young people, you've got to understand causality, you know. Action, reaction, action, reaction. It's going to keep going on and on until people go to war.
While many would argue progress has been made, the reality of racism in Britain for those experiencing it, the number of racist attacks shown by police's own figures, and the systemic disparities in housing, healthcare and employment and so on, paints a very different picture indeed.
Well, two stories lined up for this segment. First, the gruesome murder of 11 minors from Pakistan's Persian-speaking Shia Hazara community in the country's Balochistan province. Condemnation of the Prime Minister Imran Khan's reaction. Well, let's bring in Robert Carter to give us the details on the ground and also the reaction online. Robert, good evening.
Good evening, Saeed. Well, thank you very much for introducing the subject as well as you did. Obviously, this story has been in the news and on social media for a couple of days now. But the latest reaction that I can bring you is a speech made by the Prime Minister Imran Khan, who has caused absolute outrage since issuing it. He appears to have accused the families and the protesters, the Shia protesters, of blackmailing him into trying to get him to go and visit the region following the attack. Now, just to clarify, he has made clear that he condemns the incident and so on, but this unusual statement comes after several days of renewed protest by the region, where, of course, the Prime Minister has yet to visit and offer his condolences in person. We actually have a snippet of speech which has caused so much outrage. Perhaps we'll play that now and see what the Prime Minister had to say.
I sent them a message saying we met all your demands, and in addition you are demanding that the Prime Minister should come before they're buried. This is just like blackmailing the Prime Minister. If this happens, everyone will start blackmailing the Prime Minister. I told them as soon as the burial is over, I will visit Quetta and meet the grieving family.
That must have ruffled a lot of feathers, Robert.
It did, Saeed, especially on social media, so perhaps I'll bring you some of the reaction now. I've gone for the more moderate responses, just obviously to be as fair as I possibly can to the subject. Let's bring the first tweet up and see what was said. It was from a user, Shabir, who's tweeting from Pakistan. They said that Imran Khan just said that the Hazaras are blackmailing him to visit. Shias, the next time you have to vote, remember it. Remember it well. The next tweet I have, again, bringing more criticism to Imran Khan here, to the professor, who says, our Prime Minister has achieved a new low today. The most insensitive statement by a person who lacks the basic concept of empathy. Being a Prime Minister doesn't make you above the people. And the third and final tweet I can bring you on this, again, more unfriendly comments aimed at the Prime Minister. It says here that so the people who have lost their whole families for no reason are now blackmailers only because they demand their head of state to condone them. So obviously, difficult situation for the Prime Minister. I suspect he'll be doing a little bit of damage control going forward.
Let's quickly move on to your second story, Rob, and please keep it to two tweets if you can. And this one on the Israeli Prime Minister blaming the third lockdown in the occupied territories on the variant, the new variant of COVID here in the UK.
Absolutely. So the Israeli regime's Prime Minister has referred to it as the British mutation, which he claims is behind the latest spike in cases there. So obviously, this is, of course, following on from other media outlets who have referred to this new strain as the British virus. So it seems as if we're now seeing, rather than it being known as the China virus, a term coined by US President Donald Trump, it's now being referred to as the British virus or the British munition. But also what I want to mention in the quick time I have is that ultimately the Israeli regime has been criticized for other things too, like the fact that they're not allowing or handing out, distributing the vaccine to Palestinians, even Palestinians living in the occupied territories, which are currently being administered by the Israeli regime and their forces. And this is from a regime which claims that it's not an apartheid regime. But this, of course, is the latest example to suggest, well, actually, it is. And this has been noticed online. So very quickly, the first tweet I have, it should be from Zainab. It's Zainab says, and again, deafening silence across the world on Israel's inhumane decision. The illegal Zionist state also said it would exclude Palestinian prisoners from being vaccinated. And then the final tweet, let's bring that up now and see what was said. Again, criticism of the Israeli regime here from Nuruddin, who says, it is there in their law to be kind to Israelites only. This is absurd. And what Islam teaches is for us to be kind to every person, no matter what their religion. So comparing the beautiful religion of Islam, which is there to help people, and the Israeli regime, which is out to get people, especially if you're a Palestinian.
Precisely. Robert Carter. Robert, thank you. All right, our time is literally up. Thanks for joining us, and goodbye.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of the Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be examining a very important question, and that question is the following. We see that in the Holy Quran, God Almighty says that He is the sole overseer, regulator, and Lord of the universe. He is the Rabb of the entire universe. In fact, this was one of the most fundamental and essential differences between the Quranic message, the message that the Quran brought, and the beliefs of the pagan Arabs who existed at the time of the genesis of Islam. These pagan Arabs said that although God is the creator of the universe, He is not the Lord of the universe, the sole Lord of the universe. Ultimately, He is the Lord of the universe in the sense that He is the being that hands over the affairs of the universe to a series of other beings. But immediately and essentially, there are other beings who oversee the affairs of the universe and regulate it. The question that we want to pose today is this: why is it necessary for us to say that God is the Lord of the universe? He is the ultimately the only Lord of the universe. We can answer this question in a number of ways. In some of our previous sessions, we examined this by looking at the relationship between God's act of creation and His being the sole creator of the universe and His being the Lord of the universe. Today we don't want to repeat what we mentioned there. However, we want to examine this from another point of view and answer this question from another point of view. And that way is this, by saying that if there was a Lord besides God, an ultimate, an essential Lord besides God in this universe, it would lead to disharmony and disunity in the universe. However, when we examine the universe and we observe it, we see that there's a fundamental connection between the different parts of the universe, and this leads us to affirm a certain unity in it. This unity between the different parts of the universe and the harmony between them guide us towards the fact that the ultimate Lord and overseer of the affairs of the universe is one. Now, this is a concept and an idea that we see reflected in many verses of the Holy Quran. In a famous verse of the Holy Quran, in Surah Al-Anbiya, verse 22, God Almighty, he mentions this argument where he says, لَوْ كَانَ فِيهِمَا آلِهَةٌ إِلَّا اللَّهُ لَفَسَدَتَا. That if there were gods, there were regulators, there were lords besides him in this universe who oversee the affairs of the world and of the universe, it would lead to a destruction of the universe, a disharmony in it, and the unity that we see within it would not exist. Now, this is clear, and the relationship between these two premises is very clear. Obviously, if there's two beings who are fundamentally different from one another, right, the way that they regulated the affairs of the universe would be different, and it would lead to this disharmony. This argument has also been mentioned in some of our riwayat, some of our traditions. For example, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says the following: Dalla sihhatul amr wa tadbir wa tilaful amr ala an al mudabbira wahidun. That the correctness, propriety of the affairs of the universe and its unity indicates that the regulator of the universe is one. In another tradition, Imam Sadiq was asked by his companion Hisham ibn Hakam, "Mad dalil ala anna Allah wahid? Why is it that God is one?" Imam Sadiq alayhi salam recited the verse that we mentioned just now, and showed this to him and indicated it to him. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were examining the unity of lordship. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Aga, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ocean of dua.
أسألك الهدى والتقى والعفاف والغنى.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear listeners, brothers and sisters, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Rarsi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of The Ocean of Dua. In this version of the program, inshallah, we will discuss the true meaning of prayer and dua, the value of prayer, ways of reaching the Almighty Allah, acceptance, and also benefits of dua. So stay with us. Brothers and sisters, we were talking about the element of neediness, indigence, and haja, the faqr that we present towards the Almighty Allah in our supplications. But even beyond that, even without supplication, bringing the state of faqr and indigence before the Almighty Allah is counted itself as a supplication, since the Almighty Allah has promised ijabah and response to this. And even in the Holy Quran we have instances the Holy Quran mentions these points and ascribes them to the righteous servants of the Almighty Allah. We find in the Holy Quran the words of Prophet Musa ala nabiyyina wa alihi wa alayhim as-salam and his brother Harun when Allah commanded them to take his message to Fir'aun. The Holy Quran says, "Let the two of you go to Fir'aun. Indeed, he has rebelled. Speak to him in a soft manner. Maybe he will take admonitions or fear." The two of them said, "O Lord, we are indeed afraid that he will forestall us or will overstep the bounds."
Alhamdulillah, khaliq al-khalq, basit al-rizq, faliq al-asbah, dhil jalal wal-ikram والفضل والإنعام الذي بعد فلا يرى وقرب فشهد النجوى.
The interesting point in this regard is that they neither asked Allah to protect them from Fir'aun and his army, nor provide them with the security they needed. Rather, they mentioned to Allah that their weakness and fear of oppression, power, and transgression of Fir'aun is inside them, and they said, "We are indeed afraid that he will forestall us or will overstep the bounds." And Allah answered their need for support and backing. لَا تَخَافَ إِنِّي مَعَكُمَا. He said, "Do not be afraid, for I will be with the two of you, hearing and seeing. So whatever happens, I am your support." Another example in the words of Prophet Nuh alayhi ala nabiyyina wa alihi wa alayhim as-salam, which was among the other servants, righteous servants of the Almighty Allah, when he presented before Allah his need for his son to be saved from the flood. The Holy Quran in the 45th verse of chapter Hud says, وَنَادَى نُوحٌ رَبَّهُ فَقَالَ رَبِّ إِنَّ ابْنِي مِنْ أَهْلِي. He called out to his Lord and said, "O my Lord, my son is indeed from my family. وَإِنَّ وَعْدَكَ الْحَقِّ. And your promise is indeed true. وَأَنْتَ أَحْكَمُ الْحَاكِمِينَ. You are the fairest of all judges." Dear listeners, this is a very polite petition from this righteous servant of the Almighty Allah, for he did not even ask Allah to save his son. Rather, he only exhibited before him his need that his son should be saved from drowning. There is a lot of difference between asking someone directly and asking indirectly, between telling him to save your son and telling him that your son needs to be saved. So, neediness and indigence are among the places where the mercy of Almighty Allah descends, and that's what the prophets knew in advance and in the best manner, and that's what caused them to say these beautiful words and phrases in those supplications.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, "Har khujo mushkil javab onjo ravad." Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Har khujo kashti ab onjo ravad. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Ab kamju tishnagi avar bedas. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. Ta beju shad ab az bala va az. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy of God will come towards you. Paradise, thank you Allah, now that we're here, feeling so good, about all the things that we went through, knowing that God speaks with us too, it's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. Feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
Even the animals and plants can attract Almighty Allah's mercy, but through their neediness and indigence. So when they get thirsty, it is Allah who gives them to drink. And when they become hungry, it is He who satisfies and feeds them. So, anyway, we can conclude this part about the first means. As you may remember, we were talking about the means with which we can recourse to the Almighty Allah in our supplications. And the first one was the need and indigence. But yet, there is a lot to be said on this topic. And dear listeners, if you need further explanation and information in this regard, you can refer to the article named Supplication in the Eyes of Ahlul Bayt, available in the website of al-islam.org. Thank you for staying with us. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Through half my life, yeah, Allah, oh Allah. aperture.
Being the second largest country in the Middle East, Iran is rich with a colorful bouquet of architectural masterpieces, magnificent mosques, ancient caravanserais, impressive rock tombs, and former royal cities of the ancient Persian Empire. But perhaps Iran's amazing desert landscape has been largely overlooked. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Iran's deserts are unique in the variety of their composition and surface types. A yardang, or kalut, as they're called in Farsi, is a topographical feature that has been carved out of a surface by the wind. They're most commonly found in deserts where there is a sand supply, which abrades the surface when moved by the wind, and soft sedimentary rocks that the sand easily erodes. Over time, the sand wears down the surface into beautiful streamlined shapes that are aligned with the prevailing sand-moving winds. Iran is famous for mega yardangs in Kerman, in the south of the country. Stay with us for this episode of Iran Trotter as we follow Javad to discover the spectacular kaluts in Iran.
To most humans, nature means trees, jungles, rivers, and mountains. But is that all there is to this beautiful nature created by the architect of all beauties? God is limitless. He is infinite and has created nature with infinite beauties. Nature has many and varied, complicated aspects, and the natural world in Iran is no exception. Many people do not consider deserts and wastelands as part of nature. But the fact is, deserts constitute a large part of the environment on our planet. All we have to do is open our eyes and look at these countless, peerless beauties. I'm Javad Gharai. I'm an Iran trotter, and I'm traveling to the most pristine areas of my beloved country and uncovering to you its many beauties. This time, I've come to a vast city in Kerman province, a city that in fact forms a major swath of the amazing landscape in Kerman. The fictitious city of Kalutz. I set out on a 110-kilometer walking journey to the northeast of Kerman province to arrive at my main destination. The Yardangs are located in an area spanning 11,000 square kilometers in the west of Iran's Lut Desert. The Yardangs of Lut cover an area around 150 kilometers long and around 70 kilometers wide. In the words of some researchers, this vast expanse used to be the bed of the lake sometime in the third geological period, and that in fact the yardangs, or the kaluts, are made up of brittle sediments lying at the bottom of that lake. At some point in the third geological period, the lake dried up as a result of the major climatic changes that occurred on Earth. Torrential rains and their ensuing humidity in the following periods and water erosion led to the creation of the kalutes, or yardangs. Other researchers believe the yardangs are the result of the alluvial deposits originating from Birjan Mountains in the distant past. Sharp temperature fluctuations in the Lut and the constant blowing of local winds carrying abrasive sediment loads of sandstones battering these yardangs over the years have led to their erosion. Winds that continue to lash out at these yardangs and eventually raise beautiful clay terraces to the ground. Trips to the heart of deserts and wastelands have always been risky, but studying up on such places and the risks involved in traveling to them, not to mention carrying a proper map, a GPS device, and the topographic map of the area you are traveling to, can bring the number of risks involved down to a great extent. In all fairness, one of the most beautiful areas in the Lut Desert is the Shahdad Yardangs of Kerman. I mean, there are few places in the world with such beautiful desert landscape. I think nowhere in the world can you find a landscape as vast as this one. I am in the Lut Yardangs, hoping for a good trip, and I'm positive it's gonna be a thrill. I stepped onto a part of the river that not many people were interested in traveling to for several reasons. The flight distance between the Yardangs and the Yalan Megadunes in the west of Lut is around 150 kilometers. For several consecutive years, part of the Yalan Megadunes was announced by NASA as one of the hottest spots on Earth. This is an area where temperatures run above 70 degrees in the summer. With no trace of life among them, the Yardangs of Lut look scary to human eyes. Although in recent years, some researchers have discovered and registered a number of plants and insect species in them. But at first look, the fictional town of Kalutes or Yardangs bears no trace of life of any kind. Encountering sandstorms in the desert or getting lost in them, or all the other hidden dangers of such terrains, can put your life at grave risk. But none of those reasons stop me from walking right into the Yardangs. You can enjoy spending time in this beautiful natural landscape with enough information on its climate and terrain, and by using a map and GPS device. No one has found any trace of human habitation in the Kalutes area, not in the past and not in the present eras. But on the outskirts of these beautiful Kalutes, there are many remnants of human habitation from years gone by. The Kalutes are located on the outskirts of Shahdad, a city in Kerman that is among the most ancient in Iran, a place with a more than 6,000-year-old culture and history. The world's oldest metal flag was discovered here. The many qanats and water reservoirs on the outskirts of the Kalutes, as well as the lush gardens of Shahdad, are evidence of human settlement in the distant past. Right at the beginning of the route, I came across an area with a concentration of strange Kalut formations, a place famous for its egg-shaped hills. I have to walk a long distance to get to the heart of the Shahdad Kalut. But the beautiful elevations you see behind me, which is sort of the prelude to the main Kaluts, are called the egg-shaped hills, and for good reason. They really do look like eggs, although these hills are considered as little Kaluts. The reason they've been abraded more than the other Kaluts in this region is rainfalls and, of course, the type of soil they are made from. And if it goes on like this, rainwater and wind are going to destroy them in the not-too-distant future. Every spot you go to in this region, you see new and different Kaluts or Yardangs. The majority of those who travel to the Kaluts are not aware of the diversity of the landscapes in this terrain and its natural phenomena. But the fact is, the Kaluts of Kerman are a peerless kaleidoscope of beautiful desert landscapes. Everywhere you look in this region, you see spectacular yet peculiar sights. Around 7 kilometers after the egg-shaped hills, I arrived at another strange yet interesting scenery. From a distance, I thought I was approaching some prehistoric cemetery. But well, this is not a cemetery. These mounds are called the Dolphin Hills. In fact, they are very small Kaluts in the vicinity of the big ones. The dual action of wind abrasion and rainwater has chiseled them to look like dolphins swimming on a wave of dust and sand. Every part of the Kaluts in Shahdad has its own unique shape. And these Dolphin Hills are among those unique parts of the Shahdad Kaluts. These are really extraordinary, really beautiful. I've been walking around in the Shahdad Kaluts for hours now, deep into the heart of these remarkable protuberances. Although it is fall now, and the best season to travel to the Lut Desert, and of course to the Shahdad Kaluts, early spring is also a good time. Anyway, it's noontime and very hot. It was very cold in the morning, but now the temperature keeps going up, so I'm going to have to take a layer off. The temperature in the desert fluctuates sharply between the morning and the evening. It's always like that. So you have to remember to pack the right clothes for summer and winter weather. That's what it's like in the desert. You get summer and winter weather at the same time, happening within hours of each other on a single day. You should keep that in mind. It's really getting hot here. I just hope it'll stop right there as we approach noontime. Because, I mean, the heat from the sun can just be unbearable. Although I've already thought of something for a situation like this, one of the most important things we have to carry with us when traveling through deserts and wastelands are glasses, sunglasses that is. They're very important to protecting your eyes against the scorching sun. When the rays of the sun reach the dirt, they are reflected in your direction and bother your eyes. The air here is very clean. That's why there is so much light. So you have to wear sunglasses if you ever come to a place like this. If you don't, your vision is going to get hurt, and you're going to get wrinkles around your eyes. And that's what the ladies are very sensitive about. Thank you. The dazzling beauties of the Kaluz redoubled my enthusiasm for traveling into the heart of these sand formations. But the deeper I walked into them, the more arduous things became. Walking on the sand in the punishing heat requires strenuous effort and drains your energy. The day started out cold, but the temperatures kept going up as I approached midday. The biting autumn cold was nowhere to be felt. Walking on the sand and grit really wears you out after a while, and it makes you sweat a lot too. It's starting to get really hot. I better change into something more suitable. I'm wearing a thin layer, but the short sleeves expose my forearms to the sun, and that means sunburn. The sun is just bearing down on me. I feel like it's burning my face. I mean, I really had to change my clothes to avoid getting sunburn on my arms. The sun can get really annoying round about noontime out in the desert, even if it's not very hot. You're bound to get sunburned. So you must wear long-sleeve shirts with good breathability at the same time. I mean, that's what I always do. And I've never run into any problems because long sleeves have always protected my arms against the sun. Now, more important than wearing long-sleeve shirts out in the desert is to have proper headgear, such as this hat. What this hat does is it prevents the radiation from the sun from reaching your head to a great extent, and as a result, your face, neck, and ears won't get burnt. It really feels good when you wear one of these. And of course, a good pair of sunglasses is a must-have in a place like this. But there is another type of sunglasses, that I carry with me all the time. These are called storm goggles by some and skiing goggles by others. It's important to pack a pair of these goggles too, because when there is a sandstorm, when strong winds start blowing, they kick up a lot of sand and other particles into the air, and the goggles prevent them from going into your eyes. More important than that, you can see where you're going when you're out in the sticks without worrying about sand getting into your eyes. Man, I'm beat. It really wears you out when you walk on sand and up and down on those little hills. It's just fatiguing. I dare say, walking about in the Kaluz area and the hot areas of Lut Desert in the summer is next to impossible. The temperatures are so high and the surface of the earth so hot, you won't last more than a few kilometers. That's a time when you cannot see any living creatures in the Lut Desert. You can only see them during the night. It's very important to carry enough water when you travel to a place like this. If you're going to spend 2, 3, or 4 days trekking in the desert, make sure you have enough water. That's because you sweat a lot and your body loses a lot of water. And obviously, when that happens, you become dehydrated. In addition to that, you have to eat food that contains salt. But if your food doesn't contain enough salt, you need to eat salty nuts. That's because your body loses a lot of sodium as you sweat in the heat, and that's going to harm your body. Okay, now let's eat an orange. The Kaluz expand intermittently from the west of the Lut Desert towards the southeast. The corridors formed among them look in the same direction as the Kaluz themselves, that is, in the direction of the local winds. They are all very brittle. The shape of each Kaluz depends on how it was first formed, its density, and the direction of the winds that brush against it on their paths. Shifting winds and other erosive factors in the Kaluz basin has created a variety of them with different shapes and sizes. In some places, winds have filled the depression around the Kaluz with sand, and in other places, they have blown away the sand from around them. Now, let's take a look at the etymology of the word Kaluz. Kaluz is a blend of two words, Kal and Lut. Together, they mean the city of Lut. In the Khorasan region, in central Iran and along the coast of the Caspian Sea, the word Kal has taken on different meanings. In Khorasan and Sistan and Baluchistan, it's the root of words such as Kalate and Kalat, meaning castle or citadel. It could also mean a hamlet or a village perched on an elevation. In the center of Iran, the word Kalat means a walled-off village. The Kaluts are an imaginary city. From a distance, they look like the remains of a ruined city. Of course, there are a few other areas like this in some parts of the world, but the Kaluts of Iran cover the largest such area in the world. Without human interference and technology, Mother Nature has put on display her unique artistic talent and creativity. It was starting to get dark. When on a nature trip, it's important that the nature traveler find the right spot where they can pitch their tent before the dark sets in. That will ensure a good night's rest without any trouble. I'm going to call it a day now, and I think the best place for me to camp out is right here next to a lone Kalut surrounded by sand. The wind has created this hole here as if to prepare it for someone to set up their tent in. This is perfect because here I'll have my back to the wind, which usually blows from the heights of Sirj Mountains back there towards the Kaluts. I mean, that's why this hole has been created. This Kalut hasn't allowed sand to accumulate here, hence the evenly shaped depression around it. It's just the perfect place to camp out. We're spending the night here. It's a great spot, and hopefully we're gonna have a star-studded sky above us. Okay, I've been told I wouldn't be able to find any firewood or shrubs or any living creatures because deep in the heart of the Kaluts, the winds are so strong they won't allow any vegetation to grow on their path. In other words, if a plant grows here, it gets blown away by the wind. But there is an exception to that rule, and that is an area located on the path of floodwaters flowing down to the Kaluts area from the Ravar Mountains. The floods uproot the shrubs on the banks of the rivers nearby, the ones near the Kaluts, that is, and dump them in the seasonal river that's created near here and eventually brings them over to the Kaluts area. I might be able to find something there to make a fire here tonight to keep me and others warm. The temperatures in the Lut Desert fluctuate constantly, making life a bit difficult for nature travelers. Therefore, I always pack warm clothes and a good warm sleeping bag. Another beauty of the desert is its star-studded night sky. In the absence of light pollution, you get a clear view of the twinkling stars and part of the Milky Way. You can spend hours feasting your eyes on those beautiful celestial bodies that adorn the expansive firmament above. I'm glad I found these sticks. It gets really cold out here at night. I rarely make fire during my trips because I set a lot of store by nature and even dry sticks of wood. These sticks are a form of energy. They are no different than oil and gas, so we shouldn't use them recklessly. As I say, I don't make fire when I camp out unless I really have to. Most of the time, I don't need to. And when I do, I make a small one. But in the Lut Desert and in the Shahdad Desert, temperatures fluctuate a lot. I remember coming here 3 years ago. One night, winter was about to come to an end. I mean, like 2 or 3 days to the end of the season, 3 years ago. That night, right here in the Lut Desert, the temperature plunged to -1 degrees. Here's the thing. In the day, at midday I mean, I had traveled deeper into this area and experienced temperatures as high as 43 degrees. That's a huge difference in one single day. It was all very strange to me. But well, that's what deserts are like. It's typical of them. It can get really cold during the night, especially during fall and winter. Therefore, you have to have proper clothes to wear, and if you manage to find a few sticks, you can keep yourself warm and enjoy yourself sitting around a campfire.
This is Foresight.
a program on how to worship Allah. Today's tip: what are the blessings of congregational prayers in our Ubudiyya? When it comes to Ubudiyya, the servitude of Allah, exalted and blessed is He, we find that Salatul Jama'ah, the congregational prayers, the prayers that are prayed in a congregation, there are many rewards and blessings for this congregational prayer. And so the person who goes out of their house to participate in congregational prayers and waits in the mosque, the masjid, for these congregational prayers gets the reward of a person who is engaged in prayer for the entire time. Now, just as we were saying, it is unbelievable, but just going to the mosque, actually leaving the house and going to the mosque and then waiting for the prayer, all of this is rewarded for a person as if they were in prayer. Allahu Akbar. And we also find in Kanzul Ummal that the more people that are present in the congregational prayers, the more is its reward, divine rewards. This is a statement from the Messenger of Allah, the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, who says, "That which is greater in number is more beloved by Allah." Now, of course, we have to keep quantity and quality in mind. For in certain things, quantity is not greater than quality. But here in the congregational prayers, we find that quality is very important, but quantity is also very important. And so it is these congregational prayers which give us great blessings and great rewards and really increase our spirituality when it comes to our ubudiyya, our servitude of Allah.
Allah, 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 Rabbi, la sharika lahu. Allah, 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 Rabbi, la sharika.
Dear listeners of the program Foresight, my name is Muhammad. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from Munajatul Muridin, which means the whispered prayer of the devotees.
I am the poor,